am Conor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, and I am immortal.
A dead guy named Nash.
You talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places.
I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain.
Well, everybody's got their problems.
You're alive. Why didn't you die?
Hey, it's a kind of magic.
Hi, I'm Candy.
Of course you are.
Hello, and welcome to Another Time MacLeod, the only podcast that we're aware of that goes through the 1986 classic movie Highlander, scene by glorious scene. I'm your host, Rob Daniel, and as always, I am joined by my kinsman, Mr. Rob Wallace.
And as always, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. It's been a little while since we've done one of these, we were just saying.
It has indeed, but luckily, because we're both immortal, that's not really a problem.
Oh, you've given the game away now. I thought we were keeping that under our hats for the final episode.
Oh, you're right. Yes, you might need to cut that bit. And I'm not sure if our guest is immortal, but we have a splendid guest today. So you may have heard him on the quite wonderful Let's Jaws for a Minute podcast. I am, of course, referring to MJ Smith. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Robs.
And we are really thrilled to hear what your thoughts are.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I watched Highlander specifically to be on this podcast. I'd never seen it before.
I think, MJ, I think you might be our first guest on the podcast who had never seen Highlander previous to, sort of, before today, I guess.
Oh, wow. I didn't know what to expect from it necessarily. And it's a lot more... I'm trying not to sound mean, and it's not that I didn't like it. I thought it was great, but the first half is pretty slow and the second half really is kind of full steam ahead. But I really loved that it took its time in the first half to kind of set up the character and the world the way it does. Like it's a film that takes its time, but it takes its time in a much more meaningful way than these sort of other 80s B-level sci-fi movies would. You give them credit for, I think.
Well, first of all, this is a completely safe space, so you can be as mean as you want about it. And that's really interesting. So what was your knowledge of Highlander before watching this movie?
I knew obviously the iconic line that there can only be one thing, and then the cutting off of heads. And my biggest frame of reference for Highlander was watching like Saturday afternoon television here, and Highlander the series was airing as I was growing up, and I never watched the show, but it was the commercials were ubiquitous on the channel that it aired on. So I mean, I feel like every commercial break they were advertising Highlander the series, so I saw a lot of the commercials. And then I do remember at one time, so my family was really close growing up, my extended family. We all lived in the same hometown, and we would be at someone's house every weekend. And there were four films that they rotated through that they would just have on in the background. Two of them I saw as a child, and then two of them I didn't see until I was an adult, besides the bits and pieces I saw. So it was weirdly, you guys remember that movie Simon Birch?
Yes.
So Simon Birch was one of them. Independence Day was another one. And those were the two I had seen, like sat down and watched start to finish as a kid. And then the other two were From Dusk Till Dawn and Highlander. So I have memories of it being on in the background at like family get-togethers, but I never sat down and watched any of it, really.
Oh, that's interesting. So there was nothing about what you saw in the background with Highlander that made you think, well, that looks quite interesting.
Yeah, because it was mainly the past timeline stuff, so the stuff in Scotland that I remember seeing. And so as a kid, I was just like, that's the boring part, I guess, right? Like there was none of the cool sci-fi stuff happening or any of the sword fighting or action sequences that I remember as a kid. I remember just kind of seeing Christopher Lambert with the long hair and a lot of green hills around him.
So it's like, okay, so this is just like a Jane Austen adaptation or something. I'm just not interested in this.
Yeah. It was just like, I mean, this doesn't look like the TV show, because I remember seeing swords on the commercials.
Well, I've never actually seen the show, but Rob's seen quite a bit of it, haven't you, Rob?
Yeah, it's a very kind of baddie of the week. You know, so, you know, another immortal, actually not necessarily baddie, another immortal friend or foe turns up in Duncan's life, and the episode is structured between sort of flashbacks to what made their relationship and whatever the present day drama is. And then usually it ends with him having to kill them.
Okay. So it sounds almost like, baddie of the week, but also like Smallville did a lot of that, where it was this person shows up and then they're connected to, you know, Kal-El's past life somehow on Krypton, and now he has to defeat them.
Obviously, you know, Zeist rather than Krypton, but...
Well, yeah, that's one thing. You haven't watched Highlander 2, have you, MJ?
No.
Okay, no. You need to promise us right now that you never will.
Oh, wow. Is it bad?
Promise us.
Let's just say that the conversation that we're having now, when I've edited this, will be preceded with the Ironsides, you know, Kill Bill siren, which we use every time we discuss, every time we mention Highlander 2.
Huh.
It is quite simply one of the worst sequels of all time, but also one of the worst films of all time. And interestingly, it's also directed by Russell Mulcahy. So it's really odd that he then decided to completely trash this film with the sequel. But anyway, yes, it's awful. Never watch it.
There's more than two Highlander films, right?
Oh, yeah, there are so many. I've only watched the first three.
Okay.
But Rob, you've seen the rest, haven't you?
Yes. I mean, Highlander 1 is, I think, not controversially, probably the best one. And Highlander 2 is probably the worst one. And the rest are varying degrees of indifferent.
Okay.
Yeah. Highlander 3 tries to be more of a sequel to the first one. And also, you get the feeling that it's made by people who quite like the first one but hate the second one. So, yes. Anyway. So you were talking about other kind of B movies from the 80s, you know, those fantasy movies. So what films from the 80s did this one remind you of?
It kind of reminded me a lot of two, and these might be low-hanging fruit just because of the connections to them. Willow was one, just in the setting, not necessarily, because Willow's pretty high fantasy. From what I remember, I haven't seen Willow since I was a kid, but I watched it a bunch when I was little. And then, yeah, Obviously, the Queen score immediately calls to mind Flash Gordon. Flash!
Savior of the universe! Of course.
Yes, that's a good... Yeah, indeed, definitely. Actually, yeah, Flash Gordon crossed with Willow is a pretty good way to describe Highlander.
Yeah.
Okay, then. Well, one of the really good things that that Rob said was that there's one element of Highlander that you were really, really struck by when you were watching it, and we will get a lot of opportunity to talk about that today, and that is Mr. Clancy Brown.
Yes.
So I'm just going to give the code for what we're going to be talking about. So the time code for this episode is 30 minutes and 5 seconds through to 32 minutes 16. And this is, as Rob said, the first clash that Connor has on screen. Well, actually, it's the second, because we've seen him die.
Fight me.
It's the first time that Connor actually holds his own against the Kurgan.
Yes, previously their encounter was quite brief and one-sided. Is that what you call it? When the other person immediately,
yes,
like, murders you with a sword?
Yeah, I would say that's one-sided, or I guess you would say the fight is one-sided, but the sword is double-sided.
Oh, very good.
Yes, Connor can probably attest to that.
But actually disappointing for both of them, because neither got the outcome that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but based on both, you know, the previous encounter they had and this clip, the Kurgan does have a habit of prematurely saying, before he's about to finish off his enemy, there can be only one.
There can be only one! Can be only one!
Because, you know, so far, off the back of this clip, not to spoil anything, he is 0 for 2 on that.
True. Okay, then. Well, let's dive into the scene. So, this is just after Brenda has met Connor in the bar, and Connor's just been very, very weird in the way that he's acting.
Why are you asking me about the garden? Have you been following me?
I'd like to walk you home, Brenda.
And now Brenda is following Connor down, it has to be said, a rather ominous-looking street. And he pulls her into a back street that seems to be quite a big industrial area, and then the Kurgan appears and they fight. So, MJ, what were your thoughts when you were watching this scene?
I'm glad you guys mentioned that he was really weird in the bar, because and I know we didn't talk about, we're not talking about that part in particular, but I remember thinking, why is he being like such a weirdo right now? And you guys, as the super fans of the film, maybe you have a reason for it, but I really could not place a motivation behind why he was being the way he was.
Well, we talked about that a little bit on the last episode, and one of the weird things is that's just kind of how scenes were during the 80s, where it's like, well, they're going to get together at some point, this is the first time they're meeting, he's cool and a bit standoffish, and now it just comes across as he's a bit of a stalker and only right. speaks in non sequiturs that have nothing to do with what she's just said.
Yeah.
And it's like, I remember a time when this was a completely normal way to tell the love interest part of this story. And now it's like, this is just the oddest thing to watch. Nothing actually makes any sense in what they're saying.
Consecutive scenes in this film have the love interest taking turns tailing each other.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, Connor has the brass balls to call her out on it. It's like, never tail me again.
Don't you ever follow me again. You only have one life. You value it. Go home.
And it's like, you did it first. Yeah.
Very true. That's a very good point.
Turnaround's fair play, you bloody hypocrite.
Okay. He set the precedent for stalking being on the table for this entire relationship.
That could potentially, that's definitely a contender for the title for this episode. Stalking is on the table for this relationship.
That's right. I don't think we're going to top that. So, yeah, I think you might be right.
Also, when she is following him and Connor kind of clearly senses, he senses the Kurgan and, you know, understands that he's being followed, you know, separate to that, being followed by Brenda. And then just yanks her into that alleyway.
Be quiet.
The Kurgan is after him. If he'd just let Brenda continue on down the street, she'd have been fine.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, does the Kurgan know about Brenda at this point?
Not that we're led to believe.
No, there's no evidence.
So, yeah, she could have very obviously been like, I'm going to circle back around to this because that is some shit I do not want to be involved with.
That's a really, really good point. He does put her in danger quite a lot, considering that, and make her feel like she's in danger even when he's trying to be charming. So he's quite a catch.
Yeah, but his eyes, have you seen those eyes? I mean, my God.
Actually, that's just one thing. Yeah, before we get into the wonder of Clancy Brown, MJ, what did you think of the wonder of Christopher Lambert in this movie? Safe space.
He's a lot in this movie, and I know Kurgan's a lot, but Kurgan's at least consistently a lot in the same way. I feel like Christopher Lambert, like, the way he's a lot varies from scene to scene. The present-day McLeod accent he has is one of the biggest choices I've ever seen in a film.
You talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places.
Okay, so on the Christmas episode of the Robcast that we recorded, you say that you've got a pretty good ear for when somebody's doing an American accent that's not a Native American accent speaker. Could you spot that this time?
Yeah, pretty much the entire time he was speaking, whenever words were coming out of his mouth. Is it supposed to be an American accent?
No, it's, I think...
Oh, okay.
It's just not a French accent. I think that's what they landed on.
I quite like the fact that it's just presumably a mixture of all the different accents that he has had during the centuries in his travels. And as you said, Rob, on a previous episode, there wasn't a dominant one that really stuck. So therefore, it's just a weird melange.
Connor on his travels has picked up accents like you or I pick up passport stamps.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it comes across vaguely like Swedish to me. But even then, not really. It's just the closest thing my brain could like put. It's the closest box my brain could put it into. But the weird thing, like, and I feel like you're right, because I thought about this, about his accent being an amalgamation of every accent he's had to fake over the centuries, because when it goes back to like the Highlands times, it's close enough. It's not like a good Scottish accent, but like he's trying one, and he's just like not trying anything in this.
Are you scared, Connor? No, Cousin Dougal, I'm not.
Yeah. So there is a difference. I mean, it is amazing that he didn't speak English 5 weeks before they started shooting. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. He was, and his voice coach was with him pretty much in every single scene, because of course he would say words with the wrong inflection, and and she would say, no, not quite like that, let's try it like this. So it is quite an impressive performance when you take that into account. But
yes,
yeah. Would that... that it were so simple.
Maybe the funniest scene in any movie in the last 10 years.
Would that it were so simple.
Why are you doing this?
Would that it were so simple.
Just keep still.
Yeah. So, okay, so getting on to this scene, what were your thoughts, MJ, when you watched this amazing nocturnal clash that they have?
So, the first thing that I really wanted to talk about in this scene is just the appearance of the Kurgan in it is so good. It's so funny. Can I swear on this show?
Yes.
Please do.
Okay.
Yes, it's not only allowed, it's encouraged.
It's mandatory.
Okay. Just like when he pops up and it's just his face framed between the two of them, it is such a like surprise motherfucker moment, and it's so great.
Also, like, he pops up, Clancy Brown is like 6'3". What the fuck was he lying on the fucking floor?
I've got that in my notes. He would have to be crouching at their feet to appear there, and it's like, did no one see him do that when he kind of like waddled over?
He comes up like jaws coming out of the water. Yeah. To
yeah, you're gonna need a bigger sword.
Very good. That is another, god, you're just throwing out episode titles.
Yeah, there's your episode title.
This is amazing. So this scene for me really seemed like, because we've talked about the Sam Raimi influence before in some of the shots, this one to me just seemed like a Nightmare on Elm Street, in terms of it's very blue gels, there's lots of steam, the industrial setting kind of reminded me of Freddy's boiler room, and space doesn't work. There's the way that they move through space, it's like it doesn't really seem to edit together, and there's a part where they actually seem indoors, but so yeah, this one has a definite, I thought, Elm Street kind of feel to it.
Yeah, I got that. I also got that slightly. I guess this is kind of the industrial equivalent to the Scottish Highlands, in terms of previously they met, they were on a slope and they were surrounded by mist, and here it's all kind of iron and steam. So on one hand, it's a contrast, but on the other hand, it kind of vaguely recalls.
Yeah, indeed, definitely.
So for me, I didn't do any research on Russell Mulcahy until literally we started recording. But what I've learned is that he's directed like a lot of music videos.
Yes.
Like a lot of them. And it reminds me of another video he did that I saw on this list, which is the Total Eclipse of the Heart music video, which is a lot of blue gels and a lot of like lighting sources that are kind of behind everything, casting these shadows across the people in the video.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good shout. There's, have you seen the Wild Boys video by Duran Duran?
No.
Because that's kind of similar to this in that industrial leather feel to it. It's one of those videos that from the 80s, while it doesn't have anything particularly graphic in it, the TV channel's always quite uncomfortable in showing it, because it just seemed to be like something they shouldn't be showing. It's like, well, could you point to anything? It's just the tone, really. It's just the tone of this. But yeah, there's definitely lots of music video shots in this. And so what do you think of Connor's outfit, his trench coat kind of cape, which is seems to be like, you know, his superhero outfit for the modern day?
Yeah, I was thinking about that because he wears that in almost every scene he's in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me because I was thinking about, obviously, he's someone who has come up through, I mean, basically ancient or at least borderline ancient civilizations through the present day. And he's still wearing these kind of very functional clothes. He's not really adopted the style of his mentor, Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez. He is very flashy. I mean, he's a conquistador, right? He's got the red and the feathered cap and all this stuff, and very much dresses to kind of show off with the times he's in.
I mean, Connor calls him, you haven't got quite that far yet, but Connor calls him a peacock.
Yeah.
Can I swim, you Spanish peacock?
But yeah, I was going to say he's kind of peacocking around. Yeah. But Connor's very functional. He's very like... It's almost like if this took place in the summertime, he would just be wearing cargo shorts and like a, you know, button down shirt or something. It's not flashy, but it gets the job done. And that's kind of how you see him in his flashbacks too. Like he's wearing what fits the style at the time, but he's not putting a lot of thought into it either.
I think my only thing about that is it's difficult to magically hide your katana in a pair of cargo shorts.
Sure. Unless you've got some, like, Harry Potter cargo shorts. Right.
Whereas it turns out it's really easy to hide a massive sword down your trench coat.
Yes, of course.
So, yeah, so you're right. That's a really good point that he doesn't dress like his mentor. But the Kurgan definitely has a sense of style, and it's quite 1980s heavy metal video. But, so, yeah, this seems like... Mm-hmm. Quite a nice point to get on to. What did you think of Clancy Brown in this movie? And presumably you were aware of Clancy Brown before you saw this film.
Yes, I did not realize. So I saw his name in the credits, and it took me a second to realize he was the Kurgan. It took me, I think, almost until this scene to realize that that's the character he was playing. Because I think I consciously was like, I don't think I've seen Clancy Brown yet. And then he showed up in this scene and I was like, oh, I think that's him. I'm not overly familiar with a lot of his work, but I've loved him in everything I've seen him in. And the thing I have a reference for him the most in is his stint on The Walking Dead. And his figure is not used very well in that show is what I learned. So I didn't know he was a giant man. He's so intimidating and imposing and scary in this movie. And his performance is so unhinged and so great. He's so fucking good in this movie. He's so good in this movie. I just loved basically every choice he made. I mean, I think it is the platonic ideal of 1980s sci-fi movie villain performance.
So what elements of it really, really stood out to you to make that, I think, actually quite correct claim?
It's one, the way he throws himself after his initial present day encounter with Connor, the way he throws himself into that obsession, and like he will stop at nothing after he locates Connor, and that makes him really imposing. But then just kind of all the flashback stuff, even when, you know, you see his showdown with Juan Carlos, and later in the film when he's bald and like being obscene in the church, it's so unhinged that it makes him like really unpredictable. And because of that, you believe that he's a straight up psychopath. Like he is it, the the bloodlust that he's able to convey through his performance is really believable, even though it's very, like, campy at the same time.
Yes. And as you said about Christopher Lambert, there was a choice made with his voice. Clancy Brown made a choice with his voice here, and he stuck to that choice.
Yes, he did. And in this scene in particular, he bumps up against his most famous role, if not his most iconic. He gets a little Mr. Krabs in this scene when he's bellowing stuff at Connor.
SpongeBob, get out here!
Rob, I feel a sound grab coming on.
Yep, but it's probably happened before you've said that.
So for me, because this was the first time that I saw Clancy Brown, and I didn't see him in anything else really up until Shawshank, and it's like, oh, it's the Kurgan, he's in this one. And so it was one of those weird things where I then had to spend time getting used to him not playing a completely deranged psychopath. And although he'll always play quite an imposing character, it was... whereas for you, it must have been the other way around, that he's always been imposing, but suddenly here he's unhinged.
Yeah, well, like I said, he's I think he's a prisoner in The Walking Dead. And like, I'd seen Shawshank a bunch, but I didn't really know who Clancy Brown was. And he looks a lot different in The Walking Dead than he does in Shawshank. But he's a guard in Shawshank, right?
Yeah.
Is he? Yeah. So in Walking Dead, he's kind of well, like I said, they don't really use his figure to be imposing in it. He's more gentle, from what I remember of the character in Walking Dead. So to see him, like I said, I didn't know it was kind of a shock to see him both being unhinged and imposing in this, because I just didn't really know he ever did a performance this over the top and wild. And I always forget he's Mr. Krabs. But it was funny when I was watching the film, and my wife was at school while I was watching it, and then came home in the middle of the church scene. So she walks in and is like, "What in the hell are you watching?"
Just walks in to see Clancy Brown abusing some nuns.
Happy Halloween, ladies. Nuns. No sense of humor.
Yeah. Yes. And so I got to pause the film and explain to her that that man is Mr. Krabs. And she was like, sure, of course it is. And then walked away and went about her day.
Brilliant. Is there anything else to say about this scene?
Well, there's the police helicopter. The world's saddest police helicopter.
In what way is it the saddest?
The fact it kind of drops down, and it's almost a reverse of Clancy Brown popping up towards the beginning of the scene, and the fact that everybody just immediately cheeses it, and it's kind of left going, and the exact line of dialogue is, "Hey, hold it right there, come back here."
Hey, hold it right there, come back here.
It's like, you're a fucking police helicopter, have some self-respect.
You're a police helicopter, have some self-respect is a really good episode title. But also, in the same vein of how did they not see the Kurgan, how do they not hear this helicopter? Is this the helicopter that took out Bin Laden?
Like, well, I actually listened to it today on headphones, and you do hear it coming in a little bit, and it's quite... I think they're just so wrapped up in what they're doing, you could say. But, I mean, I think you'd still notice a massive helicopter, if only because it would be picking up some wind. But I think they do try to kind of introduce it into the sound mix a little bit. But, yeah, you're right, it does seem to pop up the same way that the Kurgan does.
And also, you know, in the same way that earlier in the movie, the police turn up in incredibly quick time in crime-riddled 80s New York, how was this, you know, they're fighting in a fairly remote industrial site. How on earth is a police helicopter turned up here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, especially since they have, you know, Jason Voorhees running around Manhattan.
Well, maybe
too.
That's it. Maybe they've just put on extra patrols, and there's just another helicopter that's out there, and they just say, oh, look at this, we can see something a bit weird happening down there. Looks like they're having a sword fight.
There's also when the Kurgans, you know, run for it, and, you know, said, you know, another time, Highlander.
Put down your weapons. Put your hands on your head.
Another time, Highlander. I will find you.
And the fact that Brenda says, you know, he called you Highlander. I'm guessing this must be the first time we've heard anybody call Connor Highlander.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I think you're right.
Because Fazil just says MacLeod. There's nobody else from his past that we've met up until this point. And of course, nobody in the past scenes are going to call him Highlander because they're all Highlanders.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so this is the first time that we hear the title of the movie and can do that thing from Family Guy when he hears the title of a film.
I'm telling you, these drug dealers represent a clear and present danger to the United States.
He said it.
Yep, that should have played just then.
Penn Jillette, the magician, stands up and claps in public in a theater if they say the title of the film in the film.
So it's actually Bill Panzer is the person who does the voice of the policeman. He's one of the producers on the film, so he gets a little cameo. But I don't think he's actually the guy in the helicopter, he's just the voice. So yes, for any trivia fans out there, that was one of the producers.
Wow. And, you know, I can convincingly buy that as the voice of the world's least effective police helicopter pilot.
Hey, hold it right there. Come back in.
Yeah, I think they actually took it from when he was asking to look at the budget again. And
you want to shoot where?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, actually, because this one actually bounces back between... So this scene moves back and forwards between London and New York. So the very beginning, when they're on the street and he pulls her into the back alley, is New York. And the very end is New York with a helicopter. But I think everything in the middle with the fight is London.
So it's probably about 5 minutes down the road from me.
Yes, that's another thing, MJ, is that Highlander was filmed about 5 minutes away from where Rob lives.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, I live in Bermondsey. And essentially all the interiors or anything that's not very clearly New York was probably shot, you know, a stone's throw from where I live.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's neat. Well, because Russell Mulcahy he's British, right?
Australian.
He's Australian. He's
Australian.
So, yes, he would have been Brit at one point, but obviously his family did something terrible.
Yeah. Because I was just noticing that a lot of the artists he worked with were kind of some of the bigger name British acts of the day.
Yeah, he was a rock star in his own right when it came to directing music videos. He was, I think, on speed dial for quite a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he even did a Paul McCartney music video. He did a bunch of Elton John, including I'm Still Standing, a bunch of Duran Duran, a couple Fleetwood Mac. He did a Stones video, or a couple Stones videos, it looks like. Yeah, he worked with like, everyone, it seems like.
Yeah, that's right. And then after Highlander, went back to doing a few more music videos, but was lured back to do Highlander 2. Cue the Ironside thing again. Terrible. So Rob, was there any other points that you had about this one?
I guess it's just the final shot of the scene with Brenda. Essentially, here's what seems to be a train approaching and turns, you know, at the last moment as the train goes past and essentially acts as a wipe.
It was a bus, isn't it?
Is it a bus? Okay, let's go with the bus because, yeah, that makes more sense to me than a train.
Yeah, it's a good wipe, though. So, MJ, what did you think of the transitions in this film? The visual look between as it would move from the past to the future again.
So I don't want to give away something we're going to talk about later, but that was my favorite. It's the very end of the next episode. But the time hop transitions are really, really, really great. Throughout the film, it's one of the best technical aspects, I think, of the entire movie.
And you can kind of see the music video background there, can't you, in terms of just that visual way of telling a story?
Yeah, because if you think about a music video, right, like and tons of people have gone from music videos to filmmaking. Michael Bay, right? Was he a music video director? He was a commercial director, sorry. David Fincher. And I think something that comes along with that, especially from this era where this is the generation who essentially birthed the music video, right? As an art form. And within that, you are a slave to the runtime of the song, essentially, unless you're Michael Jackson. You know, you might get a little bit at the beginning and a little bit at the end to talk about, you know, to push that narrative along. But if you really have to be efficient with the time you have, because it's on rails. You don't have, you know, a full script at your disposal to kind of play with and determine the story you want to tell. So you have to take the song as it is, determine a tone for the video, and then also determine, particularly in this time, a lot of music videos have narratives, and you have to determine what the narrative is going to be, but then you have to move through it at the same pace as the song. You have to match the pace of that narrative to the pace of the song. And you, through that, you have to pick up these editing tricks, like the transitions between the time hops in this film.
Yeah, indeed, definitely. Yeah, that's really a good point. Okay, then. So, MJ, is there anything else that you have to say about this particular scene?
Did Clancy Brown do his own sword fighting in this?
Yeah, I think he did. I think he did a lot of it. Rob, correct me if I'm wrong. I think they all had stunt doubles.
Sure.
But yes, he did do quite a lot of it, including the first scene when he appears with Sean Connery and chops the table in half to spoil at which point the sword kind of broke because he did it wrong and he didn't do it how they rehearsed it and almost took Sean's head off and apparently Sean was not very happy, but it all got smoothed over.
That's good. That's like the guitar in Hateful Eight.
What's that?
I don't know if you guys... So I don't know if you remember the part in Hateful Eight where Jennifer Jason Leigh's playing the guitar and Kurt Russell smashes it above her head.
Yeah.
And she says, she gets startled and she goes, "Whoa, whoa." And it feels almost a little out of place. It almost feels like she breaks character a little bit.
Give me that guitar. Music time's over.
It's because that guitar is a priceless antique guitar that was on loan to the production that was in a museum beforehand, and the way it was supposed to be done is to get the tone of a guitar from the era. Jennifer Jason Leigh would play it, they would cut, they would hand her a replica that Kurt Russell would then rip out of her hands and smash. Kurt Russell never got the memo that the transition hadn't happened yet. So he just went for it and smashed this priceless guitar. And so it kind of is her breaking character when she goes, "Whoa, whoa," because she's like, "Hey, we need to stop right now because Kurt Russell owes a museum like a shitload of money."
Well, yeah, so the insurance claimant on that film didn't come back with a 0-0 payout.
No, it did not.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, it was a 150-year-old antique Martin guitar from the 1860s.
That had survived two world wars.
Only to be crushed at the hands of Kurt Russell.
Well, if you've got to go, that's a good way to go.
Anyway, the reason I asked about the sword fighting is because Clancy Brown looks kind of like a natural with it. Like some of the like sword spinning stuff he does, like it feels like he really did practice a lot with the sword handling.
I think for the previous scene when he's training in the hotel room, mm-hmm. they brought in a movement coordinator. But yeah, I think you know, he definitely put in the hours, despite almost accidentally killing Sean Connery. He's definitely got some natural talent.
Yeah, and I think that's what went a long way for me loving the character so much, is because
yeah, indeed, definitely.
Clancy Brown has bought into this character, and I like that. Like he does not play this character with a wink and a nod, despite how over the top and broad the character is. You can tell the performer he's in it. You know, and every decision he makes isn't out of character for the type of person he's playing.
Yeah, indeed, definitely. Hmm. Cool. Okay, then. Well, I think that's quite a nice place to end it on Mr. Brown, because he is the star of this scene with his grunting and his lurching. And so, Emda, I think you're going to stick around for the next episode. Is that right?
That's correct.
Excellent. So, until that time, thank you very much for coming on. And if people want to find you elsewhere on the internet, where can they do it?
Sure. Twitter is probably the best place to find me, at MJSmith891 on Twitter. And then as far as projects I work on, I have, you mentioned Let's Jaws for a Minute, which is the minute by minute or thereabouts breakdown podcast of my favorite film of all time, Jaws, which I co-host with Sarah Buttery. You guys have both been on for episodes, and we have been on the Movie Robcast for the Christmas special. So yeah, that you can find anywhere you find podcasts. It's on all the major platforms, as well as a podcast called Real Perspective. That's R-E-E-L Perspective. And that is a more traditional, quote unquote, movie podcast where you talk about current release films or TV shows. We transitioned into TV shows during the pandemic. So sometimes we talk about TV, but it's you know, any sort of like visual media relevant thing we'll talk about on there.
Excellent. Well, I recommend that people check out those podcasts because they are rather splendid. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, then I'm at @rob_a_daniel, and my writing can be found at electric-shadows.com and on Film Stories and on Love Horror. And we have a sister podcast, as MJ said, which is called The Movie Robcast. That can be found on all the major platforms. And if you want to follow that, that is on Twitter as well, at Movie Robcast. And if you want to follow this podcast on Twitter, that is at McLeod Time. And you can also drop us an email at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com. And last but in no way least, Mr. Wallace, where can people hunt you down on the internet?
Well, if you want to find me on Twitter, you can do so at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing online at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com.
Excellent. Well, MJ, thank you very much for coming on and having this chat.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
And until next time...